Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are happy that you are with us today. In just a bit, we'll have another essay from Dr. Tom Easern, part of his Plains Folk Essays that we air weekly. We'll hear a report on how Indigenous skiers confront climate change and their legacy of exclusion from the sport. That's in our weekly segment, Our Living Lands. And we'll learn how farmers are facing uncertainty as the USDA climate hubs lose funding. And we begin Main Street on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we often talk about how divided the country feels right now. But behind that conversation is a deeper question. How do we actually understand our system of government, our rights, and our responsibilities as citizens? Civics education was once a core part of every student's experience. Today, though, many educators across the country, and even here in North Dakota, say it's being squeezed out, even as the need for informed, engaged citizens maybe has never been greater. My guest is Hillary Crow. She's the Vice President of Civics at the United States Chamber of Commerce Foundation, which runs the National Civics Bee, which is a nationwide competition that challenges middle school students to learn civics and propose solutions to real problems in their own communities. And with the applications for the 2026 Civics Bee closing February 17th, and with the nation's marking its 250th anniversary, it's a very topical conversation. Hillary, it's a pleasure. Welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. I'm so pleased to be with you this morning.
When we talk about civics education today, Hillary, what do we mean and why does it matter so?
So at the U.S. Chamber Foundation, when we talk about civics today, we mean the knowledge, skills, and dispositions people need to exercise their rights and fulfill their responsibilities in our democracy. So it's understanding how government works and how decisions are made, but it's also the abilities to engage in civil dialogue, to evaluate information, to solve problems together, and to approach, you know, our communities and our challenges with curiosity, with empathy, and a sense of responsibility to something larger than ourselves. We think this matters so much right now because we're living in a time when trust in institutions is low, polarization is high, and people often feel pretty disconnected from the decisions that are made that affect their everyday lives. And strong civics education helps rebuild that connective tissue, right? It helps people not, you know, in addition to understanding our democracy, it helps them learn how to practice it and to become empowered and engaging and seeing that they can create positive change in their communities in a powerful way.
You know, it seems so normal to me, but we hear that there's a lot of concern that civic knowledge is declining. And so from what you're seeing nationally, and I should tell our listeners, we're visiting to you in Washington, D.C., is civics education actually waning or is it just changing? Is it just different?
I think we're seeing both. So civics education has definitely declined over the last several decades, right? When we started investing in STEM education as a country decades ago, investment in civics education really plummeted. And so we've seen the impact of that, where not just young people today, but most adults, more than 50. So we've done some civic literacy surveys over the last couple of years. And this year, the numbers showed that more than 58% of adults can't pass a basic civics quiz, right? At the same time, only 22% of eighth graders are proficient in civics. So certainly civic literacy is declining and is too low. At the same time, we're seeing an appetite for more hands-on, relevant civics learning. And so programs like the National Civics Bee show that young people and their parents and families alike really want to better understand how our systems work, and they just need some engaging ways to learn.
We're going to talk more, quite a bit more about the National Civics Bee in just a moment. But Hillary, from your perspective, how does this lack of civic understanding show up in everyday life, and not just whether we vote once every 4 years or every couple of years or not, but in our everyday life in our communities?
It's really all around us. So you see it in community tension, in mistrusted institutions, even in simple ways like how we resolve neighborhood issues. You know, when people don't understand how decisions are made, frustration grows. Civic literacy is certainly not about elections. It's about how communities function day to day. And so we see a lack of civic engagement, you know, alongside a lack of civic knowledge of not understanding how to participate, how to create positive change. And so even not just civic literacy being down, but volunteerism rates being down and just overall ways that people have traditionally engaged in their communities are on the decline.
I think you bring up an important point. It's not just about, oh geez, I have to run for office. I can volunteer and yet still be impacted by my knowledge of what civics education is, how to conduct meetings in a progressive way, if you will, not trying to be partisan there, but in a way that's very helpful. Polarization is a thing. Becoming political is a thing. So some people worry that teaching civics can become political. So how do you distinguish civic education from partisanship?
Well, civics education at its core is nonpartisan. It's about teaching how systems work, right? How our government was designed to operate. Not what to think, but how to think, how to participate, how to engage respectfully. And so, you know, our three branches of government are the same regardless of your political party. And it's really about understanding those systems, and not about politics at all.
So in these moments of polarization, Hillary, what role then can civics play in helping people disagree productively? And I want to focus on that word disagreement, because that happens in discussions, but it can happen in a way that's productive.
Absolutely. We, you know, our founders intended for us to disagree.
And I think that might be news to some people, quite frankly, right?
Maybe. I think, you know, what productive disagreement looks like is people having different ideas, potentially about how to solve a problem. And those different ideas help make it better, right? Help make it stronger, help make it apply, you know, more appropriately to a community challenge. And so civics, I think, really helps, gives us a shared framework to start from, you know, people understanding the process, right? Something as simple as how a bill becomes a law, how local decisions are made. Conversations become less about conflict and more about problem solving. So I think it requires a little bit of a shift in our mindset to not see disagreement as a negative, but as an opportunity to strengthen our ideas and to come up with something that will really benefit our communities.
Hillary, do you recognize that students themselves sense this political tension that seems to be for us adults everywhere that we consume our information? And are students then approaching these issues differently than adults, or are they falling into the same traps, if you will, that we may have fallen into?
I do think they sense the tension, but what we see, particularly with our program engages middle school students, and we see that they're approaching civic issues with more curiosity and openness than we typically see adults doing. They see problems in their communities and they want to fix them. So we, you know, in the National Civics Bee, we see students choosing topics like mental health, public safety, community well-being. They're not getting weighed down by polarization and politics. They're really focusing on solutions, which is really important.
My guest is Hillary Crow. She's the Vice President of Civics at the United States Chamber of Commerce Foundation. And they run the National Civics Bee, which is a nationwide competition that, as Hillary has said, challenges middle school students to learn civics and propose solutions to real problems in their own communities. All right, Hillary, for those listeners who aren't familiar, what is the National Civics Bee and what makes it different from just like a traditional civics test?
Well, the National Civics Bee is a nonpartisan nationwide competition for middle schoolers that is designed to engage not just the students, but also their families, their communities. And it really blends civic knowledge with real-world problem solving. So unlike a traditional civics test, students aren't just answering questions, but they are proposing solutions to community challenges right where they live. And over the course of the competition, they're given the opportunity to talk about those ideas, to participate in rounds of questioning with judges. At the national championship, we even have team challenges where they work together with students from different states across the country on solving problems together. And so it's really about showing the knowledge, skills, and disposition I mentioned earlier that to us are really critical when it comes to civics.
Can any middle school student in the country get in on this project?
Absolutely. Every 6th, 7th, and 8th grader is eligible to participate. We have expanded the National Civics Bee this year to all 50 states, plus Washington, D.C., and even American Samoa. And so regardless if you go to public, private, charter school, your home school, as long as you're a 6th, 7th, or 8th grader, they are eligible to apply.
Even if your school isn't taking this on as a project, you individually, or maybe mom, dad listening with their middle schooler, can individually hop in and participate. How do they do that?
Absolutely. We'd love for them to go to nationalcivicsbee.org, and there's information directly there about how to enter. The students will start by writing a short essay about an issue that they care about. And then from there, students are selected to compete in regional competitions. Regional winners advance to state competitions, and then the state winners will come to Washington, D.C. to compete at the national level.
So what are the real-world community-based issues, I think, that are important to middle schoolers that you might see in those essays? Hillary, I think you mentioned mental health earlier. I'm sure there are others too.
Yes, there is a very wide range, everything from mental health to infrastructure to public safety. You know, last year, for example, some of the topics that stood out at the state level included public transportation, education, emergency preparedness, how we're caring for our elders, protecting our environment, a very wide range of topics. And these young people are incredibly thoughtful about the challenges around them and really approach these with hope and optimism and curiosity.
Once those essays are compiled, how does the process then continue on to the gathering in Washington, D.C.?
The top scoring essays in each region, those students are invited to compete in a regional competition. So at that point, they are given a study guide because we want this to be accessible to every student. Whether they've ever had a civics class before, we sort of come with the assumption that even if you don't know anything about civics, you can be successful in this competition. And so we provide a comprehensive study guide that we've partnered with the Bill of Rights Institute to create, to show them all of the material and content they may be questioned on to prepare for the regional competition. At the regional competition, they will answer a series of 20 multiple choice quiz questions. They all answer the same questions. And the top 5 scorers move on to a round of judging, a judges Q&A rather, where there are a live panel of judges asking them questions, referring back to the essay and the proposed solution that they wrote about to join the competition. And then the top 3 winners are selected based on those overall scores. And the top 3 winners from each regional competition then advance to their state level championship, where the format is very similar, but they also give a pitch of their idea that they wrote about. Then the top 3 winners are selected and awarded. I should mention there are cash prizes at the regional, state, and national level. And the state champions from each state are then advanced to the national championship.
Last year's national winner, Hillary, took home $100,000. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Beyond the prize money, what do you feel students gain from participating? In other words, after you see them, after they get to participate in the National Civics Bee, then they go home. What have you learned?
Well, we are really interested in this. We retained Johns Hopkins University a few years ago to help do a longitudinal study with us on the National Civics Bee to measure the impact that we can have on civic literacy, but also, you know, not on both quantitative and qualitative impact. So what we have seen is that students that participate are building really valuable skills like public speaking, research, collaboration, not to mention confidence. You know, many students leave saying, I didn't know I could do this. I mean, some of our inaugural champion and winners from this past year who made it to the top you know, 1, 2, and 3 slots said, I didn't really even know what civics meant when I entered this competition. And now I see myself in a totally different way. And, you know, they leave the national competition or their state competitions really ready to engage further, to deepen their understanding more, and to take on their future.
Of course, this year is our nation's 250th anniversary. That milestone must mean something to us, to our young people. And how might it shape this year's Civics Bee?
Well, it's a powerful moment. And we really believe that it's an opportunity for us to think about how can we shape, you know, to recognize this moment in time, but also how can we shape what our next 250 years looks like? And I think that's something that's particularly exciting for young people. And, you know, anniversaries like this remind us that democracy depends on every generation understanding its role. And we see that this could be a really constructive pathway into civic life that feels especially meaningful.
Hillary, one question that I've thought about while I've been visiting with you is where we get information from today. I think it's very different for young people today compared to how it was when I was a young person trying to understand. What advice do you have to young people and maybe even to their parents about how to learn about community issues, issues that affect all of us at the local, the state, national level? What do you tell folks whose kids might be spending a little too much time on TikTok or other social media platforms? What advice do you have for parents to really maybe give to their kids or work with their kids to get good information, nonpartisan, about what might matter more?
There's a lot to answer there. So I definitely recommend, I have a high schooler, a middle schooler, an elementary schooler myself at home. And something that I focus on as a parent is, you know, helping them identify the issues and ideas that they're passionate about, and then encouraging them to learn more about those. So reading information from a variety of sources that may have different political points of view, but doing independent research, not just believing, you know, headlines or things that are posted on social media, but really digging in, understanding, do these come from reliable sources, and knowing that there's an opportunity to develop some real critical thinking, right, that's required. There's so much out there that's even developed by AI today that we have to really question everything that we see. And so encouraging students as well as adults to understand that there's an extra layer and level of research and understanding that's needed, and to make sure that you're getting your news or your information from a variety of sources, and to check where that information is really coming from.
Along those lines, Hillary, and I think this has happened in our own family, I can see maybe our young students coming up maybe with different ideas and solutions that are maybe different for me as a parent or a grandparent on what maybe I felt about a problem. How do you encourage the friction, if you will, that might happen as young people learn and they discover versus, you know, conversations with their parents who may have different ideas? What advice might you give to both young people and parents when that kind of happens?
Well, it's something that we certainly encourage. So we actually prompt students to think about what are opposing points of view to your idea, and how might you work together with someone who thinks differently about this issue than you do. So we actually invite them to have those conversations in, you know, a civil and respectful way of understanding. And this really came to life even in our first national championship in the fall of 2024. We had a finalist from Tennessee who had written her essay about homelessness. And she had a particular point of view about how, you know, her community should be addressing homelessness and homeless people in her town. And initially thought that the people on the quote unquote other side, you know, were wrong and didn't understand where they might be coming from. And so in response to our prompt about understanding the other side of issues and how you could work together with people who think differently about this than you do, she had those conversations. And in the end, she found, oh, actually people on both sides of this issue care about this issue. They care about the people being affected by this. They just have different ideas of how to improve the problem. And that's a really critical step. That's something that we desperately need, I think, more and more, is not seeing the other side as negative or evil or bad or wrong, but really having an open mind and being willing to have those conversations that may initially feel uncomfortable, but can help us, you know, help lead us to a deeper understanding and even opportunities for compromise and collaboration.
All right, Hillary, the deadline approaching is February 17th. What would you say to a student who's maybe on the fence about applying or giving this a shot?
I say take the leap. Even if you're not sure, you may think, I don't really know anything about civics. I'm not sure where to start. I'm not really sure, you know, what issue I might write about. Just give yourself a chance. Just do it. And even, you know, the process of writing the essay, of thinking about your community, is really worthwhile on its own, but you might surprise yourself and you will have an incredible experience along the way and really learn and understand that whether you're a sixth, seventh, or eighth grader, regardless of your age, that you can make a real impact.
Give us one more time how we can move forward with this. Where should we go to get more information? And I should remind folks, the deadline's a week from today, but that includes a long weekend. Maybe good time for a nice project, huh?
Absolutely. So please go to nationalcivicsbee.org. If you are a parent, a teacher, or you just know a young person in sixth, seventh, or eighth grade who might be curious, looking for a challenge, or maybe need something to do over the long weekend coming up, encourage them to go to National Civics and to participate.
President's Day seems like a nice time to maybe think about civics, Hillary. My guest has been Hillary Crow, Vice President of Civics at the United States Chamber of Commerce Foundation. The deadline, as Hillary said, to apply for the 2026 National Civics Bee is a week from today, February 17th, and the competition is open to middle school students in grades 6 through 8, including homeschool students, public school students, and everyone. State winners can receive $1,000 in advance to the national championship in Washington, D.C., where finalists can compete for prizes up to $100,000. And of course, you can look more and Google National Civics Bee and get to their website. Hillary, thank you for this reminder that civics is really important, maybe not just to our middle schoolers, but maybe for all of us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Craig. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. Ahead on Main Street, from the Great Plains to South Australia and back again, historian Dr. Tom Ezern traces the curious history of the pie melon, once a staple of prairie gardens, kitchens, and barns, now nearly forgotten. That's ahead on Main Street, right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Sometimes the path back to the prairie runs halfway around the world. Today, a chance discovery in Australia leads Tom Ezern home again to an old, hard-shelled melon that once played a surprising role in Great Plains gardens and farm life. Here's Plainsfolk with NDSU's Dr. Tom Ezern.
Bear with me now, because I'm going around the world here, only to come back to my prairie garden, where I'm always looking for something new, especially if it's old, that is, vested in the Great Plains experience. I've been talking about that peculiar hard-shell melon of African origin known as citron, or colloquially as pie melon. My interest was stirred by a research junket to the Barossa, a region of South Australia colonized by German evangelicals, people like my own, in the mid-19th century. Pie melons once were a horticultural and culinary staple there. Now, out back of historic Bethany Church, the heart of the Barossa, Dr. Kelly and I found a complex of farm buildings and fixtures, both fascinating and puzzling. Most intriguing was a huge log, hollowed out to serve, apparently, as a watering trough, except we could not identify any water source by which it would be filled. So we took photos, resolved to figure it out later, and came home. Now, back to the citrons, or pie melons. It turns out that pie melons, practically forgotten today, were well known on the American plains, where they received mixed reviews. I know they were common in North Dakota among both Anglo-Americans and German Russians. Press reports on farming settlement in Burley County in the mid-1870s spoke with familiarity of citrons and noted how well they grew in local gardens. In the 1880s, citrons figured in the gardens of the Jamestown Hospital, were exhibited by Burley County farmers, and were the subject of a gotcha story in the Emmons County Record. It seems a couple of townsmen traveling in the country espied a likely patch of melons, filched a few, and brought them to town to share with friends, but on cutting them found they were citrons, not edible as fresh fruit. At points south on the plains, citrons grew lavishly, especially on sandy ground. In 1876, a woman in central Kansas found her farm, which she referred to as Pie Melon Ranch, besieged by feral citrons and declared, "In the name of Moses, tell us what we shall do with our pie melon crop, for we feel we are victims." Across Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, farm women exchanged recipes to make use of a somewhat difficult item of produce. The hard melons figured in pies, preserves, mincemeat, and most of all, citron butter, seasoned with cinnamon and proposed as a substitute for apple butter. During droughts, citrons came into their own as animal fodder, with feed value comparable to silage. Pie melons could be picked in the fall, covered with straw, and rolled out for winter feed like pumpkins. There was a problem, however. Cows had difficulty gnawing through the hard skins of citrons. To be used as feed, they had to be chopped up with a sharpshooter spade. Now, back to that mysterious dugout trough in the Barossa. Based on bulletins from Oklahoma, I realized that this Australian artifact is a pie melon feeder. The citrons could be piled into it, and the farmer could stand on the thick, heavy edges while splitting the melons with a spade. It was a bovine buffet. January in North Dakota, and I'm pouring through seed catalogs, obscure ones, and find a variety of red-seeded citrons. Come summer, if it ever happens, they're getting a trial at our place on Willow Creek.
That's Plains Folk from Dr. Tom Ezern of North Dakota State University. He contributes to Prairie Public Weekly, and we are grateful.
Dakota Medical Foundation reminds listeners of Giving Hearts Day, February 12th, a 24-hour event supporting charities in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. Since 2008, donors have helped raise over $226 million. Details at givingheartsday.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is putting snow sports like skiing at risk. For Indigenous skiers, that adds to a long history of exclusion from the sport. Let My People Go Skiing is a new film about access to snow sports for Alaska Native youth. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke to Ellen Bradley, the film's director and a Tlingit skier, about what skiing means to Indigenous people.
What inspired you to tell this story through skiing, and how has returning to your traditional homeland shaped that journey?
Yeah, so for me, skiing is something that's always been a part of my life. And skiing was kind of this tool for connection with the lands that we were living on. It was this real, tangible way to connect with the Cascade Mountains and this place I was living that I didn't have the same blood ties or connection to like I do in Southeast Alaska. I feel really lucky that skiing has maintained being part of my life, but has become so central to my life and what I'm doing today as a professional skier, and hoping to use that as a tool to break down some of these barriers so that our Native people everywhere can access their homelands no matter what season it is.
And how have you seen climate change impact the skiing world?
You see so much change when it comes to climate change and snow sports. Snowpacks are significantly less consistent year by year. Often, like this last year, we saw very little snow here in the Rocky Mountains throughout the beginning of the year, and then it kind of all came at a certain time. And that's a little bit less consistent than what we've seen historically. More specific to my homelands in Juneau, they had a horrible snow year. So it's kind of a really scary time to be someone who loves the mountains when they're snowy, because it's changing, and changing in so many different ways that it's kind of hard to quantify at times.
In your documentary, Let My People Go Skiing, you work to dismantle barriers for Alaska Native youth. What kind of response have you received from the young people in your community?
From the young people in our community, I think their response in a lot of ways has just been joy. It feels like this really special place that is by us and for us, by Native people, for Native people, where we can really bring each other into community on the land, with the land. And I experienced that with the kids, just seeing them have so much joy, learning how to move their bodies in this different ecosystem on these skis or snowboards in a way that is maybe a little funky to how they feel. It always reminds me that we're skiing or we're snowboarding because it is fun, and it to find more joy in that for myself as well.
Why is it important for Indigenous people to be the ones telling these stories, especially when it comes to the outdoor recreation world?
I mean, we were outdoor recreationalists before that was even a term, right? As Indigenous people, that's just our lifestyle. And I think our narratives being centered in that space, centered around stories about our experiences with the land and the way that we move with the land, is so important, because in this capitalist colonized culture that we've now found ourselves in today, being able to be on the land and move with the land is abnormal. And so to be able to return to our people's cultures of being in this right relationship and movement with the land, I think is central to determining where the outdoor industry or outdoor recreationalists should be going, or where the focus should be.
How do you balance traditional ecological knowledge with Western science in your advocacy, and what gives you hope in the fight to protect your homelands and culture?
Alaska's a vast, diverse space with so many different ecosystems. And in order to have lived in these spaces for as long as we have, we all had to be scientists. And so for me, trying to meld those two in the modern day and age feels like trying to remind science that its origins are in Indigenous ways of knowing. And trying to explain to Indigenous ways of knowing or traditional ecological knowledge that your knowledge is complete, right? That it isn't less than Western science in the ways that Western science often tries to make other ways of knowing feel less than itself. There's so much that's giving me hope these days in the fight to protect my homelands and my culture. There are so many incredible people, Tlingit people, Alaska Natives, Indigenous peoples everywhere that have found their ways and their abilities to engage in that fight for protection. And I think being able to see all of the different people who are approaching our fight for protection, for culture, and for land in these different ways, that's what's giving me hope.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prey Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
U.S. Department of Agriculture climate hubs across the country aim to better understand how climate change affects agriculture and forestry and help people adapt. But the future of these hubs is uncertain. As Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, that's as farmers across the country continue to experience more extreme and unpredictable weather.
It's 10 degrees at Heritage Hill Farm in central Iowa. Except for some garlic sprouts poking out of the ground, everything is brown and yellow this winter morning.
I'm so ready for the day where things are greening up and we're actually, able to start working in the soil again.
That's Jessica Krupika. She runs this diversified vegetable farm with her husband, their two boys, and some hired help. Even as they look forward to spring, Krupika says that season brings new challenges with heavier downpours and big temperature swings.
So that really impacts certain crops, especially like the lettuce, where the temperatures, if they get just too warm, they just get bitter. So you have a unmarketable crop.
Krupika says they're scaling back certain crops, shifting planting dates, and adding more greenhouses to stay profitable.
With the climate change, we need to be more nimble.
Over three quarters of Iowa farmers surveyed by Iowa State University say climate change is happening. And the USDA created regional climate hubs over a decade ago, in large part to help producers adapt. Julian Reyes was the national coordinator for the 11 hubs for several years.
There was a lot of great climate data, for example, that existed at NOAA and at NASA, but there needed to be an in-between, right, to translate what that meant for farmers, ranchers, and foresters. And that's where I think the climate hubs excelled the best.
Last year, the Trump administration proposed cutting funding for the hubs in its 2026 budget request. Congress slashed the funding, according to committee notes in November, but just how much the hubs will lose is unclear. A USDA spokesperson said budget allocations are still being formulated. Reyes says the hub's annual funding was roughly $30 million before he left in 2024.
They definitely punched above their weight. For the amount of funding that they received, they delivered benefits to not only the USDA, but farmers, ranchers, and foresters. I was going to say threefold. I would say even fourfold.
Illinois state climatologist Trent Ford says the Climate Hub in Ames, Iowa, makes it easier to share information and resources with researchers and crop advisors across eight states.
We know that weather and climate and the impacts that they cause don't stop it at state borders.
He says the hubs have also played an important role in supporting local research. For example, he says he struggled to get funding from national scientific groups to study how warming winters impact apple production in his state.
They'll come back and say, well, Illinois is not really a major apple producer compared to like Washington or Michigan, right? But what am I supposed to say then to the apple producers in Illinois who are trying to make a living growing apples?
Ford says the Midwest Climate Hub helped him find funding to start the research, which led to a larger report about climate change impacts on fruit trees and vineyards in the region. Lori Nowatsky is the former associate director of the Midwest Climate Hub. She says the expected funding cuts come on top of massive federal layoffs last year.
I think the more prominent impact to the climate hubs has been the effect on the ability to keep staff and hire new staff.
Nowatsky was one of tens of thousands of federal employees who were fired last February. She was rehired with temporary job security and ultimately took a deferred resignation offer. Nowatsky found a research job outside the USDA, but she worries about early career scientists and widespread federal cuts to other weather and climate research programs.
To me, the greatest concern there is that we are going to have less robust weather-related services for farmers moving forward. I think that's almost a given, considering the changes that have happened this year.
Nowatsky says farmers will continue to experience more extreme and unpredictable weather, but they may have fewer resources to plan for the future. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
A widespread collapse of American agriculture? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A bipartisan group of former USDA officials and leaders from major farming associations warned last week that without action, there will be a widespread collapse of American agriculture.
In a letter sent to the House and Senate Agriculture Committees, the group blames Trump administration policies as well as congressional inaction for the U.S. farm economy deteriorating.
Specifically, they decry the indiscriminate and haphazard nature of tariffs that have increased costs for production while reducing prices for farm commodities.
They call out bellicose rhetoric and chaotic trade policies that have caused longtime trading partners to question the reliability of the U.S. and turn to other countries. Additionally, cuts to foreign aid and domestic food programs are negatively impacting commodities such as rice, wheat, and peanuts.
They add that mass deportations under current immigration policies are reducing the labor supply, causing food to go to waste, and increasing prices for consumers.
Farmers, they say, don't want government handouts. They want markets, referencing a $12 billion farm aid package Trump offered in December to offset market disruptions.
They point out that farmer bankruptcies have doubled. Barely half of all farms will be profitable this year. And the U.S. is running a historic agriculture trade deficit, a sharp reversal from record export surpluses and farm incomes just a few years ago.
The group lists 9 recommendations to save U.S. agriculture and the rural communities they support, such as rolling back tariffs, pursuing free trade agreements, passing a new farm bill, and fully funding research.
According to a new report, there is a huge gap between predictions made by scientists and those by economists about how the world will be changed by global warming.
One might think that governments, central banks, and institutional investors, such as retirement funds, would try to forecast economic risks from climate change as accurately as they could.
However, a new report from the University of Exeter and Carbon Tracker says they are not. And they are relying on models that increasingly understate the failures, shocks, and risks to the economic system as the world moves toward 2 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels.
The forecasting models view global warming as just a rise in average world temperatures and see the future economic system as stable instead of factoring in tipping points and extreme calamities.
The report says forecasts focus on GDP, which can mask the full cost of climate disasters. That number can fail to account for human death, displacement, and degradation of ecosystems.
Tipping points like the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, the collapse of Atlantic Ocean currents, or mass biodiversity loss would have serious effects on national economies.
Using outdated models for economic forecasting is resulting in widespread complacency and the continued underpricing of climate risks, according to the authors, not only among institutional investors, but also policymakers.
As part of the recent spending bill passed by Congress to avert a full government shutdown, legislators voted to cut in half the $250 million allocation for programs to remove lead pipes from municipal water systems.
The cuts will hurt Michigan, Illinois, Texas, and New York the hardest, as they have the highest levels of lead in pipes, according to The Guardian.
The EPA has said that no level of exposure to lead is safe, particularly to children who could have low birth weights, stunted development, and lower IQ scores.
In the past, water utilities and the chemical industry have fought hard against rules to replace lead pipes, saying that they were not feasible, and Republicans have backed them up.
However, according to E&E News, the American Water Works Association, which represents 4,300 utilities, recently asked Senate leaders to reject cuts to the program, warning that local communities would have to bear the burden. And finally, you win some, you lose some. Last week, a federal court judge rejected yet another attempt by the Trump administration to halt offshore wind along the Atlantic seaboard, their 5th loss in as many weeks.
Donald Trump has made no secret of his disdain for wind energy, calling turbines ugly and falsely implying that they cause cancer. At Davos in January, he called European nations losers for installing them.
In December, his Department of the Interior issued stop work orders for several offshore wind projects, claiming they were a national security threat, a premise judges seemed to find full of hot air.
Indeed, these projects were reviewed for nearly a decade and were coordinated with the Department of Defense before entering into contracts to provide clean, cost-stable energy to consumers.
This latest ruling allows the Sunrise Wind Project, some 30 miles off the coast of New York, to resume. It joins Coastal Virginia Wind, Empire Wind, Revolution Wind, and Vineyard Wind, all of which have been cleared to continue construction.
It's estimated that the projects combined will generate 6 gigawatts of electricity, enough to power 2.5 million American homes and businesses. That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents A Night at the Oscars, February 21st at the Fargo Theater. Conducted by Jane Lind Capistran, the program features the FM Choral Artist with music from Oscar-winning films. Information at fmsymphony.org.
This is Bird Note. If you're looking for a way to volunteer your time to benefit birds, consider Project Nest Watch. Organized by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, Project Nest Watch is made up of volunteers around the world who monitor bird nests, reporting whether the birds successfully raise their young. Joining the project involves a bit of online training, finding a nearby bird nest, and briefly checking on it every 3 to 4 days without disturbing the birds. It's easy and fun to do, and it helps scientists keep track of how climate change and alterations to birds' habitats affect their ability to raise their young. Thousands of participants in dozens of countries help Project Nest Watch understand how bird parents are doing each year. And the project's website has tips for finding bird nests, building nest boxes for a species of your choice, and landscaping with bird families in mind. I'm Michael Stein.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 10th. County names and boundaries have evolved since territorial days in North Dakota, and each of our 53 counties has a unique story that enriches the history of the state. Dunn County's story is one such example. Created by the territorial legislature in 1883, the county was named after John Piatt Dunn, an early business and civic leader in Bismarck. Dunn opened North Dakota's first drugstore and arrived in the state in 1872. Dunn County organized its government on February 10, 1908, with Manning selected as the county seat. Unfortunately, no Dunn County newspapers from around that date exist in the state archives collection to chronicle the momentous event, but the Dickinson Press did note the government formation in its February 15th issue. Meeting in a building owned by W.P. Owens, all newly elected county commissioners and a large group of voters were present for the organizational meeting. The first order of business was organizing the county into commission districts, which went smoothly. The district, overseen by Commissioner Connolly, included the townships north of the boundary line between townships 144 and 145. Commissioner Kovash's district covered the southwestern part of the county, while Commissioner Lewis oversaw the southeastern townships. Commission Chairman Connolly and Auditor T. Leroy Evans were tasked with soliciting bids for a contract to transcribe the county's records, which were to be opened in Dickinson on February 19th. Walker Brothers and Hardy received the contract for the county record books. Schools were the next agenda item, with Chairman Connolly's commission district divided into 2 school districts. A petition to form a school in Commissioner Lewis's district was granted, while other petitions to form schools were to be considered at a later time. The final major item of business noted in the article was the selection of the Dunn County News as the official newspaper of the county. County formation was an important part of the state's development, and many years of boundary changes, county creations, and dissolutions across North Dakota have led to its 53 unique political subdivisions. As population shifts within the state, we may someday see the number of counties change. One thing remains certain: counties are the foundation of our government and play an important role in our daily lives. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwine. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow, a conversation with the good folks at the North Dakota Women's Business Center, the statewide resource dedicated to helping small businesses and entrepreneurs thrive. We'll explore how NDWBC supports business owners through coaching, training, funding access, and community connections. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.